Hello, and welcome to ngbuild-pod, where we share with you our knowledge of Angular, all the mistakes we've made, and some of the things we've gotten right. I'm Chris Kamak, and with me as always is John Graham. We're both full-stack Angular developers that love to share and be part of the developer community. We both work here at Miles Technologies in Lumberton, New Jersey, on the Engine team, and we've spent the last several years building out our Angular template for the Miles software division. Except, John, we're not at Engine, or not in Lumberton, New Jersey this time, are we?
We certainly are not. Like I'm sure a lot of our fellow developer community, we are hopefully all working safely from home.
Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you what, I definitely feel fortunate that I work in the type of job where this is easy to do, that our company is well set up and well formatted for remote work like this.
Yeah, I mean, my wife doesn't work in technology, and they are trying to adapt, and it is not easy. Seeing them go through a lot of struggles and things, so I'm glad that, you know, like you said, it's pretty natural for us.
Yeah, it definitely feels good to be in this position. Earlier in my life, I was not so lucky. This would have been a much harder thing to do.
yeah, for sure. So what have you been up to recently, Chris?
Well, in addition to staying in my house, I've actually been having a really good time using Stadia, which is that Google gaming service. I think you've talked about it a little bit, and it's working really well. I just picked up the Division 2 for Stadia, and it is so beautiful and so fast. I had it also on the PS4, and that's how much I like that game, so I bought it twice. but it's so much better in this form. I can't tell you how much I like Stadia. It's so good.
Yeah, and you forced me to purchase Division for the PC. So now there's that. I haven't played it yet.
Yeah.
Though.
Well, it does have crossplay, so that's why you got it on PC. I have it on Stadia. We can actually still play together.
Yeah, I'm not interested in buying games twice.
Yeah, I can see that. How about yourself? What have you been up to other than spending a lot more time at home than usual?
Yeah, actually, I mean, I really like it. I've worked remotely pretty regularly, just not to this extent. It's tough because you have two kids and the childcare is closed, or well, they just recently closed it, but we've had her out for a while, just out of precaution. And
that makes good sense.
Yeah, and it's a little tough, to be productive. I've had to work a few nights to try to make up for it. But, one of the things that is nice is, I am home. I have a long commute to get to work. So for me, you have a similar length commute. So for me, I feel like I have a lot more of my day back. I haven't listened to as many podcasts that I usually listen to. Certainly listen
to podcasts.
I certainly listen to ngbuild-pod regularly. But the other ones have taken a little bit of a backseat. But it's nice. I get to been taking my daughter. She's learning how to ride her bike. So I've been running behind a bicycle every day. That it's been nice. I'm actually enjoying it. Quarantine for me is not so bad. It's a kind of business as usual with I'm home more.
Hey, well, that sounds pretty good, actually.
Yeah. Cool. Right, cool. So
what is it we're going to... Oh, I was going to ask you, what are we talking about today?
Yeah, yeah, that's great. You're switching the script on me.
Why not?
Yeah, so today we're going to actually talk about authentication with Angular. And there's a lot of different methods for authentication. So a lot of the applications we build here at Miles, they communicate with a web API, which handles the interface to, the business logic and the database calls. Authentication is important because you don't want to have unauthenticated database stuff flying around there. So early on in the template, we kind of worked on a structure and built what I think is a pretty cool setup. So we're going to talk about kind of all the pieces of that from an Angular perspective so that people can kind of get a feel for all the things that are involved when you're building authentication for an enterprise application.
All right. That sounds like a real good thing. I know a lot of people in some of the classes that we teach, like one of the first things they want to know more about is the authentication side of things. So hopefully this is a topic that helps people out.
Yeah, definitely. So let's jump right in. And I think probably the easiest thing to talk about first is our logging component.
We want to do our quick tips, though, right?
Oh, my goodness. I skipped the quick
tips.
How
could we forget that?
So this is our first remote recording, you know, because Chris and I don't want to, you know, we're practicing good social distancing. There's a, you know, about 30 miles between us right now.
Yeah, that's what the CDC recommends.
Yeah. 30 miles between each human. So, you know, we're a little off kilter here, but we'll get through it. Yeah, quick tips. Okay. How about you go first? We'll just totally switch everything up.
Yeah, no problem at all. All right, so here's what I have. A lot of times when you're working on a code base with a team, you're going to end up in a situation where you're going to be doing merge requests. We do them, you know, all the time here at Engine. So one of the things that we found out over time is depending on the size of the change and how much of that affects UI directly, it can be really hard from a code perspective to really understand what it looks like. Like, of course, you can see the code, and that can give you some indication of what you're dealing with. But you know, we're not all Neo. We can't all just see the Matrix and explain that that's exactly what, you know, I'm looking at. So one of the tricks that we've done, and I think it really is, I hope that a lot of people will start doing this because it really makes things so much easier. We've started to take snapshots or pictures, sometimes even video clips of the UI changes that have happened with this merge request, and we post those up as a merge comment. So, you know, when the merge is ready and we say, hey, this is ready to take a look at, we also give some documentation visually so that people don't feel like they have to pull down the code base and run it just to be able to see what it is that changed.
Yeah, and that's really useful for, like, the UI perspective, right? So obviously we go in, we check the logic, we make sure everything's working, we give feedback. But when it comes to, like, the look and feel, you know, like you said, having to pull it down and create that scenario you need or set it, get to that section of the system, it's really, you know, nice just to look at a screenshot or watch somebody walk through. And the thing I like about it, too, is I can go back to it. And, like, if it's a video of you explaining some complicated thing you did, I don't have to, like, remember everything, right, or understand everything. I can jump back later on and re-review the video. Like, I think I've done a few of those for merge requests that you've done. So that's been helpful for me.
Yeah, I think, you know, using short burst videos as a form of documentation is something that we could certainly do better with overall.
Yeah. So for me, I have, you know, been tweaking my home setup here, trying to get it exactly the way that I want. And so what I did recently is I went with a vertical monitor, and a primary monitor, because I only have two at home and I don't like that bezel, like right in the middle. I kind of like having a primary monitor and then a secondary monitor. At work, I have
three. What kind of sizes are we talking about here? Like what's the footprint?
27 inch. Is the size for both. Yeah. So at work I have three. So like the middle one is my primary and then I have two off to the side. But yeah, they're 27 inch. They're like some crazy gaming monitors that I probably don't need to buy, but I just got them anyway and I wanted the same one. So I got two of them. But yeah, so the one of the things that I didn't like is like, I like snapping. I'm a big like hotkey guy, you know that, and I snap things. But with a vertical monitor, Windows really doesn't easily support snapping top and bottom. So I actually found this pretty cool tool called Windows Power Tools. And I would definitely recommend it for people that are like, you know, trying to get into some productivity hotkey type things. Because the cool thing is that when you hold down the Windows key and you have Power Tools, it like pops up with a big like shortcut help window. So you can see all the different shortcuts you can do with the Windows key, like snapping and all that different stuff. But the other thing it lets you do is it lets you set screen layouts. So I've been looking at getting ultra wide monitor. Like, that's my thing.
Ooh.
That I'm stopping myself because they're just really
expensive. No, it's
exciting. But I definitely, like, am thinking about just switching to an ultra-wide and a single vertical. But the problem with an ultra-wide is you really only can snap two screens, right? One to the left, one to the right. But with Power Tools, you can actually set, like, screen templates. And they override your Windows hotkeys so that when you're snapping, you can say, well, I want to be able to snap left, middle, and right. Not just left and right. And in my case of the portrait monitor, I can do bottom and top. So the hotkey to snap normally is Windows left and right. So when I do Windows left and right on my primary, it does left snap, right snap. When I do Windows left and right on my portrait, it does top and bottom. So it's okay. Really cool. So it kind of kept my, you know, the flow I'm used to.
Still feng shui.
Yeah, my feng shui didn't get thrown off. And I get the benefit of a vertical monitor because sometimes, you know, you want the full thing if you're reading like a big document or code, but other times, like, you know, when I'm helping through, like when I'm referencing things, I might want two things up on that. So that was cool. It's called Windows Power Tools. It's just on Git. And you download it. And like I said, even if you're a beginner, it gives you like the guides and stuff like that to set these things up and use the hotkey. So I would check it out even if you're not like a hotkey person like I am. It's really
cool.
And
we'll be sure to put that into the show notes as well, so it's an easy link for you.
Yeah, definitely.
Very, very cool. All right, so how are we going to start this thing off? How are we going to kick off authentication?
Yeah, so, you know, fast forward now to the part that I was trying to get to, which is, you know, we have a couple different sections we want to talk about. So maybe I should start there because there's a couple different pieces to authentication, right? There's what the user sees. There's how you handle authentication on the front end, right, on the browser. There's the communication between the front end and back end. And then there's some little aspects in there that are important, like what do I do when somebody is when their key is no longer good, or how do I handle it when somebody logs out, or how do I check, that a person is even logged in. So there's a lot of little nuances there, and we're going to dive into kind of all those different nuances throughout it. But I think a good place to start is like where a user would start, which is with our login component. And the section that they see kind of first when they get in. So, you know, what's kind of the important things to know about when it comes to the login component when you're handling authentication?
Well, I guess one of the big things to recognize is whatever authentication pieces you're using, if you're ensuring that people can't log into or can't go to certain routes, when they're not logged in, well, then your login component better be an unguarded route, like, and any calls it needs to make have to be allowed to be, anonymous or unguarded as well. So, I mean, I guess that's the biggest thing to keep in mind. Also, it's nice to have login options. I think right now our template supports both like a username password. It supports AD login, I believe, or credentialed login via direct network, or Active Directory, I should say. And we also support, I believe, a Google login right now. And it'd be easy to add other things like, I know that some people out there have like Facebook login, you know, things like that. We could certainly add those in, but for right now, it just hasn't been requested. But anyhow, you know, nice options for different login options or different ways to go with login is a good feature. And I recommend people look into doing that. But even if we're just talking about a username password, I think that's a pretty standard setup. And most of the time you can, you know, you look to anything you already use and say, well, what does that look like? And that's kind of the way you'd go about it.
Yeah, there's really not a reinvention of the wheel here with login screens. There's been plenty of them built, and you don't even need to really think about it. But the important thing, like you said, is just, you know, how is this different from the other components in my system? And the major difference is the fact that it's unguarded or unauthenticated, right? Because you can't be authenticated at the login screen. That's the point of it. But some like gotchas there that we didn't think about initially was like, what about forgot password? Right, that's another screen where you're kind of unauthenticated. So there's a few processes that you may need to think about where you may or may not want to add in, a guard. And we're talking about an Angular guard, which is like a guard on a route, right?
Yeah, let's even just jump into that one because that's one of the things that we're planning on covering.
Yeah.
The concept of a route guard, we end up using a class here called an auth guard, but that's just our invention. It's just auth and guard together. But anyway, that's what we call the class. But technically, from an Angular standpoint, we're using something called route guard. And that's if you wanted to look that up on Angular.io, there's some good examples of that. But essentially, what it comes down to, it's a service or a class that has an at injectable on it. At injectable is what I assume you're going to want because you're probably going to want to have some dependency injected in there. But in any case, this guard class or whatever implements something called canActivate. And that's the piece that comes from Angular that basically defines what it is that you can do there. Now, this canActivate says that you have to have a method on there called, I think the method name that it requires is activate or canActivate. But in any case, it's just a single method. It has to be there, and it has to return an observable of Boolean. So it can be whatever logic you want in that method. You could check all kinds of things. You could, you know, try to access local storage and say, hey, did I already have a login from this person? Do I know who they are? Are they authenticated? You could check with a service to say, hey, is this user already authenticated or not? And if they are, do they have the certain role access possibly? If we're not just talking about are they logged in, but we're talking about do they have a certain role that they're fulfilling? You know, you could check all kinds of things, but essentially, at the end of the day, it's going to return back an observable of true or false. And if it's true, you're allowed to go to the route. And if it's false, the route won't load. It just doesn't load at all. So, I mean, that's the basics of how a route guard works.
Yeah, and so, you know, what we're trying to do there is we're trying to ascertain in the guard, you know, whether or not the user is allowed to have access to something. So we talked about with the login component, it's guardless. It doesn't have a guard. But every other route in our system, we do apply this auth guard to, because, you know, we're just trying to figure out, hey, are you really supposed to be here? Are you logged in? That kind of thing. And like you said, you just return true or false. Now, you know, just to go one level deeper on the detail there, I don't think usually return false, because like then nothing happens. Usually what we'll do is we'll reroute them, right? So if we detect you know, they're not supposed to be going to this route, we'll say, hey, do you have, you know, should you be going to like the default route, which you have access to, or should you be going to the login screen because you don't have a valid session, something like that.
It's an excellent point. And, you know, the way that we do that, I think we do actually return false, but it's irrelevant that we do. It doesn't matter, because we've already called the dependency of router from Angular and said router.navigate, and we sent them back to the login page if they weren't logged in. So the fact that we sent false back is, it just doesn't matter that we did, because it's no longer going to be evaluated because we're going to go straight to the login page.
Right. But let's talk about that a little bit more, because it does make sense to actually return false in some cases. You know, we gave a scenario where like it doesn't make sense because we just want to send you somewhere else. In Angular routing, it has this concept of where you can have multiple guards on a single route. So, you know, so you may have, you know, two or three guards, and I think maybe you have some a quick example of what one is. But the idea behind returning false is that you may want to continue because the guards happen in order, right? So from left to right, you put them on the route. So I put the auth guard first, and then say I put, you know, user guard or something like that second. I may return false from the auth guard, but I still wanted to evaluate the next guard in the line to see if maybe something else is, I return true there because I wanted to evaluate the next guard in line. If I return false, I don't want it to evaluate the next guard in line, and I just want to stop the process.
That's correct.
So we have this like chainable guards here. Do you have an example of like where you've seen that in action?
Well, sure. And I think one of the things to consider here is that what we're talking about is a route definition, right? And so the route definition is an object that has on it a route guards parameter. What does it take? It doesn't take one guard. It takes an array of guards. And just like you were talking about, so the one on the left, or the first position, or is position zero of that array, is the first that gets handled. And every single one of them has to say return an observable of true in order for you to be able to actually navigate to that route, for it to become the active route. But if any of them say false at any point, it doesn't evaluate anything past that point. But this is a great opportunity for you to practice modularized code. Because let's think about this from a standpoint of, let's say I wanted to guard certain routes from default users. I only want admins to be able to go to those routes. So if that were the case, I might be inclined to try and find a way in my off-guard to determine if this is one of those routes and check not only are they logged in, but are they also an admin? And I could do that all in one guard because I can put as much code in there as I like, so certainly I can do that. Question is, should I, right? And I say no. I think the better option here is to separate the concerns into two different guards. And sometimes maybe I only apply the auth guard in that array and that's it. And other times I apply the auth guard and then I apply the admin guard. So I separate those two pieces out and it evaluates both. Plus, let's say that I wanted to present some sort of messaging, right? And let's take that a step further too. In the auth guard, I probably want to reroute you to the login page. I don't want to just tell you you're not logged in. I want to actually send you to the place where you can do that. But in the admin guard, I don't want to send you anywhere. What I really want to do in that scenario is probably put a message on the screen that says, hey, only admins can get to that page. You know, or right. Something that indicates what the problem was.
Right. Yeah.
So, I mean, I think it's a good way to do it. It's a nice way to separate the concerns out and build multiple guards. And then just apply them in order, all the guards that are needed for that particular route.
Yeah, you have a lot more flexibility when you do it that way. From an implementation standpoint, you're not doing a bunch of like if checks and stuff like that to find out what scenario you're in.
So yeah, and this is one of those cases too where, you know, you're building an observable and it's got to make a certain call and then it's got to eventually return true or false and you're sort of chaining those together. It can be complicated once you put enough conditions in there. So why make that more than it has to be? You know?
Yeah, definitely. So I think that kind of explains the role of an auth guard and how you use it and what it's used for. You mentioned at the beginning that you probably want to make this an add injectable class, right? And so the reason that we want things to be injectable in Angular is so that we can pass dependencies into them. And so one of the things that we pass into the auth guard is a dependency on something that we've called, again, we're, you know, really good at naming stuff, is the auth service, right? And so the auth service is really where a lot of the logic lies to determine what we want to have happen in the auth guard, right? The auth guard, like you said, true, false, can I get through, can I not get through? We don't want the auth guard figuring out if you're actually logged in. We just want it querying if you're logged in or not, and then taking action based on that result. So we create this auth service, which kind of sits as a base understanding of, you know, hey, what's going on with this user right now? And how do they have, you know, what do they have access to? Are they logged in? Are they not logged in? Information about the user, stuff like that. So I think, can we maybe talk at a high level about what are the components of the auth service? Because we utilize that again in the auth guard to handle, you know, the actual logical checks that determine whether or not we let you pass through.
Yeah, I mean, we should certainly talk about it. And I also think the auth service is one of our better examples of having a service that's you know, maintaining itself and kind of has a sort of a very, very light state about it, right?
Yeah.
So here's the things that an auth service knows about or cares about. It knows who, if anyone, is the current user. You know, if it's null, then nobody's logged in. If it has a current user, then that's the person who's logged in right now. It also has a method that you can call for logging in. And the reason we put that in the same service is because we actually want it to be the one that maintains the currently logged in information. So you call this login route, which essentially is going to use the HTTP client service, right? It's going to return an observable of the endpoint to my backend that's going to verify this login attempt. And when it returns, I do a pipe tap on that, right? Because we talked about this in the RxJS episode that, you know, pipe tap is how you can do something with the information when someone else subscribes to it. I always just say someone else. I'm always putting people into the code.
Computers don't write their own code yet.
Yeah, not happening. So anyways, when it gets its return back, if that was a successful login, it'll take the information it received from the login, use that to store the current user information, and that's how it can keep track of that. So it also has this concept of is there someone authentic? Is the person who's currently logged in authenticated, yes or no? Do we know who they are? And that's really all the OffGuard needs. It just has to say, are they authenticated, yes or no? If they are, let them through. And if they're not, don't. And you know, we also store in there some token information, which kind of leads into the next thought process. So do you want to maybe take us down the road that is JWT tokens?
Yeah, so we'll circle back to like the, you know, storage and like some of the components of how we know a user is actually logged in. But it is kind of important to understand what it is we're actually storing first. So we use JWT tokens. JWT stands for JSON Web Tokens, which is just kind of a open format for how you can store securely information about users on client applications. So, you know, for instance, you may want to not only, you know if a user is logged in, but you may want to have like their user role or, you know, some other information about the user that's going to be important. So when you're working with RESTful APIs like we are, you know, we build the APIs and they're RESTful, you don't have something that's called state, right? So there's this state concept in Angular. I'm talking about state at a more global level, meaning there's no, you know, active session or there's no concept of what, you know, there's no connection between one request to another, right? So what we need to have is we need to have this token. And what this token does is we take it and we send it with every request to our API, and our API reads it and parses it and says, okay, I know who this user is because I see this token. This is a valid token because I've checked it against what I know is a valid token, and I can decrypt it and I can say, okay, this is the user ID. This is the user role. Maybe this is their first name, last name, things like that. So it has a lot of that information. So, you know, that's kind of the things that we're storing. Now, the Angular application is not responsible for creating the token. It's really only responsible for storing it and taking it and passing it along to the request. So when you go back to our login component, we'll have, like you were saying, in the auth service, we have a login route that we pipe tap. What happens is we call the login route, we pass the credentials into the API. The API validates those credentials, hopefully in a very secure way that is non-decryptable.
It better be secure.
Nobody writes insecure applications this day and age. But we'll do a whole nother topic on security. But so the API is going to say, okay, this is a valid username and password for my system. I can authenticate this user. And so what the API does then is it uses some libraries to create the JSON web token. Now, the way that the web token is created depends on your API implementation. In our case, we use .NET. So we're using .NET libraries to do it. In our bootcamp, we use Node. Node has a very popular middleware called Passport, which is a very common thing that lets you kind of do JSON Web Token and identity and all that stuff. So the actual implementation of creating the token depends on your backend tech stack, which you're using. But the API is responsible for creating a token. So the login route passes username and password, and it gets a web token in a response, which is encrypted. So like somebody can't just go and read everything that's going on in there. And it has an expiration and things like that. So that we can see who's currently validated to the system. So it's nice because with JSON web tokens, you have the ability to pass data back and forth. But you got to be careful with that, because, you know, you don't want to just throw everything in there. I think, you actually fixed a problem we had with how we were doing JSON Web Tokens, because we are not perfect. Usually we do a gotcha section, but I think maybe you want to just talk about that scenario real quick.
Oh, no. I'm gonna wait for the gotcha section. Oh, you want to wait. Because okay. There's a lot to cover here, and I just want to make sure that we step back. I want to roll back just a
roll
second,
back.
Because, I mean, I agree with everything you said on the JSON web tokens there, but we're sort of stepping right past what some of these little pieces are and how they interconnect. So I think that we should go back to like a more fundamental 3-minute conversation here on what we're discussing. So essentially we're saying there is a service on the Angular side that's going to call a route for logging in. And that route that it's hitting is going to be on some API. Now, the API in our case is that .NET, like you just talked about, the one that we use on the engine team. And it's really just a web API. You log in, and it's the one responsible for storing, tracking, checking, and eventually returning the JWT from the login, assuming the login was valid.
Right.
And so it sends that back, and it does it probably as a payload, but it might also do it as a cookie. And it could do it in multiple ways, but essentially it's coming back somehow on that response. Now, the auth service, again, now we're back on the Angular side again. Mm-hmm. That auth service, it's going to say, okay, that was a valid login. I have a token. I need to store this information somehow, some way, because I'm going to need to use it later. And that's the part I want to key in on. When we say use it later, what does that even mean? It means that every time we make a request from this point forward to that API, I want to smack a header onto every one of those requests. And that header needs to indicate that we have a token, and here it is. And in the case of JSON Web Token in standard Web API format, the header's name is authorization.
Yeah, and then it has bearer.
Exactly. It has to have bearer, space, and then the token. And there's just a little format. You could look it up, or we may provide some links in the show notes here. But essentially, keep in mind that what it's doing is it's saying every request from this point forward, we got to put this bearer token into the authorization header for all of these, because that is the thing that the web API is now going to parse. It's going to say, do you have a header? Do you have the authorization header specifically? And if you do, do I know what that token is? Is it valid right now? You know, and that's kind of what the auth service is doing. We haven't talked about how is the bearer token getting put into the header. We will get to that. That's coming. We also haven't talked about how does it store the token. And that is another section that we're going to be getting into. But is there anything else from the fundamental standpoint that you think we should cover on JWTs? Because it's a lot of information that we're giving here. I don't want to gloss it too much.
No, I mean, I think the only thing I would add, just to put a little bow on the concept here, is that, you know, we talked earlier about auth guards and guarding routes against whether or not you're logged in or not. Now, the way that works on the client side is through the auth service via parsing the token, things like that. But there's a very similar concept on the the API side. So much like the login component is not guarded, the login endpoint is also not guarded on the API, because you're not going to have this authorization header that you were just talking about. So what you do when you're designing your API, or you're building it, or maybe you're interfacing with one, which is the easiest way, right? You don't have to build it. You just interact with one. Is that you need to know which routes are authenticated and which routes are not authenticated. And the ones that are authenticated are doing this process that you just said, which is they're passing the token through, and then the API parses it and things like that. So it's different on how obviously it does things, because it depends on your tech stack, but the concept carries over, I think, from our guard conversation we had at the beginning. So I just want to tie those two things together so people can think along the same lines. If I have an auth guard for a component, probably anything that component calls on the back end is also going to have a similar authorization requirement, because, you know, you have to have it on both ends. Since it's client side, people can circumvent it. You know, if I get something like Postman or Insomnia or some sort of REST client, I can just call endpoints. So those need to be authenticated as well with these sort of, you know, quote unquote guards that we've been talking about. But that's the only thing I wanted to wrap a bow on. But maybe we can talk about saving the token on the front end. I think that's a good thing to talk into. And then we can dive into how it actually gets passed through into the API.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I would love to jump into that. I mean, first thing, the auth service is just going to make use of like a behavior subject. So it's going to store that in a behavior subject observable. Anytime we ask for the token information, the auth service is just going to go ahead and serve that up. But you may already be knowing that there's a trap coming here, right? Because let's say
it's a trap.
That, Yeah, it's a trap. Let's say let's say that I refresh the page, or I close my Chrome browser and I go back and start it again and say, yeah, let's go back to that site again. Most of the time, a user is going to expect that it still knows who you are. And that's because anything that's got JavaScript these days has probably got cookies enabled, right? That's the way that we're going to store it there. So we're going to store it in some kind of cookie that's going to be local to our site, and it's going to store that token information. You have to be super careful when you're working with this stuff, though, because cookies, if you're not careful with how you work with them, can be a little bit insecure. So I certainly recommend, when we do get to a security version of our security episode on our podcast, we'll probably jump more into that. But let's just talk about functionally what's happening. We're going to receive that request. So we tried to log in. It returned back a token. We're going to do two things with that token when that happens. First, we're going to actually update the currently logged in user. Then we're going to store the token into an observable, so anytime I need to get it, I can. But then we're also going to take that token and the information about the user, both, and we're going to store those in a cookie. And every time that these things change, we have to change all the places. So if you log out, we clear everything. We clear the current user. We clear the behavior subject with the token in it. And we're going to clear the cookie out. So really, that's maintaining a state in that situation. Now, the cookie is really where the persistent state is, you know, because now if we go and close the browser, go back to open the browser again, go back to the site, every time this auth service spins up, every time it is constructed, it's immediately going to go say, do I have a cookie with a token in it, yes or no? If I do, let's load that directly into the currently logged in user. Let's load that directly into the behavior subject that stores my token. So it basically rehydrates itself every time using this cookie.
Yeah.
That's pretty much the way that we've done it. We've used an NPM package that's, I believe, NGX-cookie.
Yep.
Which is an Angular version of working with a cookie, and we found it to be a very good one for us.
Yeah, and the thing that, you know, just to be clear on like what happens under the hood, because I don't think we actually discussed this in the RxJS episode, is, you know, when you hard refresh, meaning like you hit F5 or you go to a website and you come back, we talked about unsubscribing and making sure you're cleaning up observables and behavior subject and things like that. But when you do these hard refreshes, you know, Angular loses its state, right? So all your observables are gone. All of your, you know, your behavior subject values get removed. There's nothing there. So if you have a current user behavior subject with which your application uses, because, you know, you don't always want to have to hit the cookie all over the system. You want to just hit this behavior subject. When they refresh, it's gone, right? It's basically the same as unsubscribing without ever resubscribing. So like that's just the concept I want to make sure people understand about Angular, is that when you do that harder, if you're routing, no problem, right? You're routing through the Angular application, it's staying within its state, it doesn't get reset at any point. But the minute that you know, like F5, go to Google, come back, things like that, close your browser, reopen it, you're resetting that state. So that's why it's important to have the cookie and to be able to read from the cookie to initialize the state of the application, right? To say, is there an actual current user that I already know about? So that's good. I think that's...
I agree. And you certainly could use other methods. You could use local storage instead of a cookie.
Yep.
There's other ways to go here, but you do need something that persists beyond the app's life. That's pretty much what it comes down to.
Okay, so I think we've talked about the login component. We've talked about the guards and guarding your routes. We've talked about the auth service, which handles a lot of the communication between your application and the API. It gets the JWT tokens, it stores them in cookies, it sets behavior subjects, it gets all these things ready to go. So, you know, at this point, you know, your application, you know, from a front end standpoint is working, it should be good to go. The piece that we're missing here is, well, hey, now I have these authenticated endpoints that I want to call. And when I call them, I need to pass in this user information, this JWT key. in this authorization header, like you said before. But, like, you know, yeah, so I can bring in the HTTP client, I can set the headers, I can, you know, pass the headers into my HTTP client calls, and that's a way that you could do it, right? But you certainly want to think about, you know, when you get to larger scale or a bigger app, you may have 100 HTTP client calls, you may have more than 100, you don't want to accidentally forget to pass the key in, because then things won't work. So there's a lot of gotchas there if you try to implement it over and over and over again. So, you know, the concept that we're getting to here, the thing that we use to handle this for us is Angular interceptors.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I love interceptors. I think they're the coolest thing.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about a couple ways we use interceptors, more so than just to get this header problem solved. So I'm excited to talk about that. But what I'd like to maybe do is pass it off to you to go into what the header does, and then I have some comments on some other really cool ways that we've used interceptors to help us out with this.
Totally. All right. So get ready, because this is the bomb stuff here. This is super cool. All right. So
I'm holding Angular, tight.
Oh yeah. Angular interceptors are very similar in how we described how route guards get done. They're a class. They're injectable. You know, they have a method that you put on there of HTTP interceptor, and they get provided a little bit differently. Again, we'll provide a link to the Angular IO section that'll give you more of the formatting and how this works. But let's talk about it conceptually. It's essentially a class or a service. But what is its job? It is going to run. Here's what it does. It's going to run against every single API call that you make from here on out. Every single one. And what it will do is it will give you an opportunity to modify that HTTP request that you're making in any way that you like, really. But in this case, what we're trying to do is we're trying to say, if I have a token, then I want to add a new header to the request, and that new header should be authorization, and it should have in it the bearer token. So pretty straightforward stuff. So in this situation, we're just basically grabbing the when you call, or this, the method that's on this class that makes it all run, I believe, is called intercept.
Yep.
And again, when you put that when you implement this HTTP interceptor, it'll tell you you've got to have this method, and here's its signature. So you're just going to follow suit with that. But the way that it works is intercept provides you, as one of its parameters, the request, the one that we're talking about that's about to be fired off. And what it's going to do, we can then say, okay, auth service, do I have a token? If I don't, then we just say request.next, I think it is. But essentially what we're doing is we're saying, go ahead, you're fine, request. I want you to go to the next handler. When I say next handler, that's because you can have lots of interceptors. You don't have to just have one. They'll run in order of when they were provided. So the first one that was provided is going to happen first, so on and so forth down the line. But think about it from this standpoint. I can do anything I want to that request prior to saying next, and someone else gets to do something with it, or some other interceptor gets to do something with it before it fires off to the APIs. So, I mean, this is super powerful stuff here. So in this situation, for the header, what we're going to do is we're going to just take the request. Now, it doesn't let us set the header directly. We can't just say request.headers and access that grouping and say, I'm going to change something there. It's a little bit careful to make sure that you don't just go willy-nilly changing properties, but you can do a request.clone. And when you do that, it gives you a brand new version of that request that you can modify things on. You can make changes to. So we request.clone, we say, hey, this new clone has a new set of headers. Here they are. And then we say, send that into the next request, or the intercept's next request. And so now we've modified the request and said, you're what's going forward. And it's such a powerful thing that you can do there. I mean, like John said, imagine that you had hundreds of HTTP client calls that you were making, and whenever you had a token, you wanted to add it. This is a way of modularizing that. You know, you don't have to do that anymore in your services. It just knows what to do. So, I mean, I just love it. I think it's so good.
Yeah, and like it builds this pipeline, right? This pipeline of what is a request. And like, for instance, we have one that happens before the token one, which is to add the base URL, right? So like I don't want I don't want to have to type out the base URL of the API in every single HTTP client call, right? I just want it's the same. Like everything.
Sure, even better, that's something that's not always the same depending on my environment,
right? Yeah.
So like if I'm in an environment of develop, maybe that API I'm hitting is called localhost 3000 or localhost something whatever.
Yep.
The point is it's running on my development server, my local computer's server. So that's where I'd be targeting. But when I'm in prod, it doesn't hit localhost whatever. It goes to a specific URL, but the API's URL is the same. It's just the beginning part that changes. Instead of localhost 3000, it'll be, you know, something.prod, you know, .com or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And so this interceptor you're talking about allows us not only to not have to write that base URL, but it allows it to be a variable. It can literally be something different in each environment. That's so powerful.
Yeah, and then, you know, it just does request.next, sends it to the next one, which is going to intercept to do the token if it needs to. So quickly, before I go into my example of some of the cool ways we've used interceptors, the one thing that I didn't hear you touch on that I think is important is, like, how does it know the order to fire the interceptors in? Because I remember I made this mistake a while back, and it took me like an hour and a half, and I was like, I don't know what's going on. Let me ask Chris. And I had to get you on, and you had to tell me, oh, yeah, you're just, you know, you didn't do this correctly with the interceptors. So how does it actually know the order in which it fires the interceptors?
So the interceptors are going to be provided probably in your app module, but they could be in other modules possibly. And when they're provided with a special token. And that token is an HTTP interceptor token. And you also say multi-true on that providing statement. But again, this is if you're wondering like what all it is that I'm talking about there, this Angular.io link that we'll give you in the show notes is going to point you right to the right spot. But essentially, it's a special provider statement that you lay out for these interceptors. And the order that they are provided in, so the first one it sees, the next one that's provided, the next one, that is the actual order that they'll run in against an HTTP request.
Yeah, so it works a lot like routing. You know, when you're defining your routes, they are loaded in order, right? So you don't want to have a conflicting route below another route because it will never get to that because of how the ordering works. So the interceptors are the same way. Same way with like when you're loading in modules or loading in components, like everything's kind of in an order process there. So that's important to know because you control the flow of the pipeline, you know, as it goes through. So that's cool. So let me give you some really cool things that we've done with interceptors.
Lay it on me, John.
So one of the things that is important with authentication is being able to re-authenticate a user. And so what happens is with our JSON web tokens, they expire. So you talked about, you know, if I leave the application and I come back, I want it to know I'm logged in. That's true. But if you leave the application for a week and you come back, do you still want it to know you're logged in like a week later? Because that's, you know, a bit of a security risk. You know, say I log into like, you know, a shared computer somewhere and I forget to log out. You know, I don't want somebody that logs in after me to have admin access to, you know, some secure system. So
right. And also, I just want to throw in there because I know where you're thinking. And I just want to say, in this situation, it's also very important that we don't let any web token be valid too long.
Yep.
Because if it's valid for, you get to set the expiration, right? So if you say that this thing is valid for 2 minutes, that's an okay chunk of time. But if you said it's valid for 2 days, well, what if somebody somehow, some malicious user out there is able to access the bearer token through some request that was made? If they're man in the middle, I think is what the term is there. If they're able to grab that token and start using it, how long should it be valid for? It's kind of the question.
Yeah. Yeah, and we're getting into a little bit of a security conversation, which I know we've
I'm going the wrong
that's
direction.
That's okay. We've been passing that off to the future podcast. So we'll discuss a little bit about the security ramifications, why we do that. But the concept is that your tokens eventually are no longer valid. They do expire. So what we actually do with JSON Web Tokens is we provide, when you log in, your actual token, and then we also provide what's called a refresh token. And your actual token, like you were mentioning, doesn't have a very long life. It doesn't take very long. Like it sits around for a little bit and then it expires. The refresh token does have a longer life, and we store that as an HTTP cookie, so you can't actually access that through the client like we're doing with the normal tokens. So what happens is that, you know, eventually after like a couple hours, your token expires, you make an API call, and you get a 401 because your token is no good. So we have in our Angular applications a global error handler. Again, another episode on how to handle global error handlers. But basically what happens is global error handler looks for a 401. When it detects a 401, it tries to refresh your token. And you know what it will do is it will say, hey, do I have a refresh token? Can I get a new token? You know, this is just kind of a flow we have. The important piece here is like, you know, you're probably loading a page when this happens. And if you're loading a page and it's JavaScript, it's going to keep going, right? You're going to make an API call, you're going to get a 401, and then maybe I have two or three other API calls because I'm like loading dropdowns or loading a list page or getting status information, whatever the case is. It keeps going, and all of those would normally 401 as well, right? Because again, your token isn't valid yet. And JavaScript just kept going, and it processed these requests. So we've actually wrote this pretty cool interceptor to where as soon as we detect that a 401 happened, we set a behavior subject saying, hey, I need to refresh this token. And when we set that behavior subject, this interceptor checks to see if that is true or not. If it is true, it holds the request. It doesn't keep going, right? It doesn't do that handle next like you were talking about. It grabs it and stores it into its own behavior subject. I think it's just a subject, actually. It stores it into its own observable, I'll say. That's a safe way to say it. So because we know we need to wait for the reauthentication to happen. So it stores any request. So if I have three or four or more requests, rather than them all 401ing, it grabs them and says, whoa, don't call the API, wait till my token is refreshed. So we have that behavior subject saying we're refreshing the token. We re-authenticate your token. We get a new one. We reset that to a false, which I'm no longer refreshing. And we replay all of the old requests that come through. By that subject, right? So we take everything in that subject and we just fire off all of the requests that it has stored with a now valid token. Really cool thing with the interceptors, and I know that's kind of a complicated concept, but you know, hopefully it makes sense, is that you don't want to just like, you know, what would happen normally if you didn't do anything is you would refresh the page, it would give you a new token, but the page would be empty or blank or error out because all of your other requests would have happened asynchronously and not returned any data. So you want to have this concept of replay or resend your requests after you know that you now have a validated session.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is one of the cooler things that you wrote this, right? That you wrote all this logic, I'm pretty sure?
I pulled from a lot of online resources to write this logic, but yeah, I did put it together.
I think it's one of the cooler things that we have in there. I mean, you know, the fact that it's so fast, the fact that it is able to basically hold back these other calls so that they don't also fall into the same trap. And then just replay them seamlessly. I mean, as a developer, I don't even know this is happening and it just works. And I just don't even have to think about it.
Yeah, and it's a really great user experience because nothing weird happens on the page. Like, it just waits a little bit and it loads like it would load normally. And the user really has no idea that they had a bad token and now it's better now and all that stuff. So it's really cool. I enjoyed writing it. It was really fun, like, use of observables and pipelines and things like that.
Yeah. Go interceptors for the win.
Yeah, they're awesome. Cool. So let's go into a few gotchas. We're running a little short on time, but we do have time for some gotchas here. We definitely have to get to the one that I mentioned earlier that you refused to give the people what they wanted, which is, you know, being careful what you actually store in the JWT token. So do you want to talk about that scenario real quick?
Yeah, you want me to go into that now? All right, sure.
The people need to know, Chris. They need
people
to know.
People need to know. All right, so the JWT is really cool. It's encrypted data. It's, you know, only valid for a short period of time. But You can put whatever you want in there data-wise. You basically give it an object and you say, this is the thing I want you to encrypt, along with your special, you know, your special situation, your special salt, I think it is, in order to encrypt it to be valid for that only one, that one section. But essentially, though, the amount of data that you give it is now a question. Because if that token has to go back every time that any request is ever made, well, there is a length that you cannot exceed on headers. You can't have an auth bearer that just goes on forever.
Yeah.
There's a maximum length. I don't actually know what that max length is off the top of my head, but we did run into it. And the reason we ran into it is because we wanted to send back all of the claims with a user. So in our systems, the way we're doing it is there's like a user role, and the user role has different claims that it has, such as, do you have a claim to the users section? Do you have a claim to the company or the customer section? Do you have a claim to the vendors section? And then specifically within the vendor section, do you also have the ability to see documents that the vendor has posted? Yes or no? You know, so every type of authorization claim question you can think of, we store as individual bit flags, if you will. And the way we're doing that is we were loading it all into our token. And it was handy to do that because we would send it back as a token. And then when we sent the request off to this RESTful API who doesn't know who you are, having it just pull all that information out of the token was really nice because the API is the one that's got to make sure that you actually have the ability to see this thing, that this is a claim that you have on your token. That didn't work out, though, long term.
Yeah.
because we underestimated the number of permissions that one of our clients wanted to have in an application. I want to say it was on the order of 200 plus.
Yeah, I think they ended up close to 500 by the end of the
application. Wow, okay. So it went even beyond that.
Yeah.
Well, somewhere around 200, we weren't able to store the information anymore. It was like, nope, we can't even make requests. Your header is completely invalid now. So we had to stop storing that much information in the JWT. So this is the cautionary tale. Be careful about what you choose to store into the JWT. If it's something that is variable and could grow in size, you probably want to avoid it.
Yeah, and this is a limit of like the HTTP protocol, right? This doesn't have anything to do with Angular. It doesn't have anything to do with APIs. It's like HTTP as a protocol can only send a header that is a certain size. And I think it's like probably 255 or something like that. You can Google it. So the variable things are really tough to do. One other gotcha I want to go into maybe before we hit on our final thoughts. And we talked about it a little bit, but it is a tough thing to figure out, which is how do you handle our route guards on the front end when, permissions aren't valid, right? So we have a few things that you can think about in a system that you want a route guard to control. First of all, you want to control access, right? So if like a user, you know, goes to a specific URL and the URL they don't have access to, you want it to prevent that, right? But not many people type in a URL, right? Like they go to the base one and then that's it, right? Then they just kind of navigate. So the second piece of this is like, you know, what do you do with the menu, right? Like if somebody doesn't have access to the menu, to a specific piece, you know, do you want to show it in the menu? Do you not want to show it in the menu? What happens if they click on it? How does it tell the user that this thing occurred? Because again, if you just return false from the route guard, you know, it's just not going to do anything. It's just going to stay where they were currently. It's going to try to route and it's going to fail.
So, yep. And then you're going to get a ticket submitted to your project that says this route's busted.
Yeah. I click this button and nothing happens. And you're like, well, yeah, you shouldn't be allowed to click that button. So these are all considerations you have to make. We talked before about how in some of our guards, we just reroute you to where we think you should be, which is like either login screen or some home screen. We've also done some logic to hide and show menus. And I believe we do have, again, in that error handler, a way to display to the user, hey, you don't have permission to access this part of the system. So we've done some creative things there, but really it's up to you. These are just things you have to think about when you're deciding to do authentication is, well, you know, eventually somebody's going to access a part of the system they shouldn't. How do I handle that scenario? How do I handle it from a user perspective? Where do I send them? What do I display? How do they know that it's not broken? that they actually, you know, we purposefully did something like this. So the route guards aren't a set it and forget it kind of thing. You have to think about some of these, you know, more detailed concepts.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, there's questions to, do you flip the switch on visible? Like, do you do an NGIF on your menu button? Because if it's not showing, then I don't even know that it's an option. Right. And is that good? Is that good for this particular use case? Sometimes it's better to show it, maybe gray it out, and then have them know that they can't do it. So when you click on it, you give them a message, hey, you just don't have access to this. You know, so it depends on the scenario for sure. And, you know, I think there's even a case to be made for, you know, if you show an option that someone can't have access to, well, maybe you could prompt them and say, hey, you know, you could have access to this. You just need to make a request to your manager, you know, or something like that. You know, you could really build in some pretty cool functionality to sort of auto handle permission requests.
Yeah, definitely. Cool. So, you know, kind of wrapping up here, authentication is hard. It's very complicated. There's a lot of things to think about. We didn't even really talk about the security of it. We just kind of talked about the process and flow of it. So there's a whole separate podcast just on the security aspects. But, you know, hopefully you get a feel for some of the components that are involved in it. So you're going to have login. You're going to have some authentication service. You're going to have guards. You're going to have some token. You know, maybe you have JWT, maybe you use something else, and you're going to use interceptors. These are all the things, the pieces of the puzzle, so to speak, that is authentication, at least from our perspective. You know, you may want to substitute or swap one in or out, but, you know, hopefully you have a good understanding of, again, all the pieces so you can go out, research, understand what interceptors do, learn about guards a little bit more, things like that. But do you have any other closing thoughts or feelings on the topic?
Well, I mean, I guess if anything, I would say that the you know, interceptors for the win. I mean, they are the best thing ever, and I don't know why you wouldn't use like 30 or 40 of them in your application every time. So yeah, I just
I can think of a reason.
maybe not. I just think that there's so many cool things that have been built into the Angular setup that make working with authentication a little bit. A little bit less daunting, but it certainly is a complicated thing. And, you know, if you're just starting out with Angular or you've only been doing it a couple of months, certainly playing around with authentication is great. But, you know, it's probably not something that a junior dev's going to be asked to do anyway. You know, if you're on a team, that's probably going to be at least a senior dev, maybe an engineering team that's going to be working on something as complex and security conscious minded. As authentication, but you should know how it works. You should know what's going on under the hood, and you know, certainly if you're building your own app, if you're a one man show or one woman show for that matter, then you know, then that's something that you've got to handle. You got to get it done.
Yeah, for sure. And on that note, if you are a junior developer and being asked to write an authentication, reach out to us. Let us know what your questions are and what your hiccups are, or if you're not a junior developer and you've written 50 authentication processes, tell us what we're doing wrong. We'd love to hear from you and get your feedback. You can reach us on Twitter. I'm at John Graham Dev, G-R-A-H-A-M, like the cracker. Chris is at Pilgrim Secret. You can reach out to us. The podcast also has a Twitter, at ngbuildpod. So if you want to subscribe to that, we'll post whenever new episodes come out. We'd love to hear from you. Also, remember, we work at Miles Technologies. If you're interested in working at Miles Technologies on all things Angular and a lot of other great things, you can hit up our careers page at the Miles Technologies website. It's www.milestechnologies.com/careers. Is that right, Chris?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, cool. That's how you can get in touch with our company. But we'd love to hear from you. So questions, comments, feedback, let us know. Hope everybody is safe and staying as safe as possible with you and your families during this time. And you know, we're certainly, you know, happy that we can produce this podcast virtually in this day and age. So hopefully you enjoyed it and everybody's staying safe. I'll turn it over to you, Chris.
Yeah, I just want to make mention too, you know, this is our first time trying to record in a different way. We usually do it in the studio that Miles has actually put together for us. And we're doing it this new way. I don't know if the quality is the same. I certainly feel like it's different doing it this way. But we'll be back to normal when the country is back to normal, I guess.
As normal as can be.
That's about right.
Yeah. Okay, great. Thanks, everybody.
Yeah, thanks so much for listening.